Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, our theme, a countdown to crisis. For those who are concerned about the remarkable, the unique weather events that have been occurring for the past 5 years and only accelerating, well, we have had a lot of experts on, and they've given their predictions about what will be changing on the planet, what will be the likely outcome, what will be the timetable. Today, we have someone who can answer all these questions and will be doing so in a lecture format. This is Dr. Gwen Dyer. Dr. Dyer is a UK-based Canadian journalist, a columnist, and a renowned historian on international affairs. He holds a doctorate in military and Middle Eastern history from King's College in London and a past service record in the American, British, and Canadian navies. In the past, he has taught war studies at the Royal Military Academy in the United Kingdom. Dr. Dyer has been a leading voice in informing us about the truth of climate wars. In fact, he, in his earlier work, War, it was the basis of a television series aired on the BBC and PBS. His most recent book is Growing Pains, The Future of Democracy and Work, which outlines some of the greatest social and political threats in our globalized world. His website is Gwynne, G-W-Y-N-N-E, Dyer, D-Y-E-R.com. Let me mention that we found this recent lecture and then, because it's very difficult to find a good lecture of his. And then I looked at the date, and it was 2010. So this is already presenting information that, as he will explain, is old news. He will also explain how countries will be fighting one another, how states will be fighting one another. In the United States, we'll have legal battles. In other countries, it won't be legal. It'll be military. What makes him unique is also his capacity to be an insider. Gwen is able to go into countries and meet with the presidents, the leading military. He has met multiple times with people within our intelligence community and our military-industrial complex. He is a favorite of the Defense Department because he gives the truth to them about what is likely to happen when we run out of food. Think it's not possible? It's happening right now around the world in multiple locations, more than 100 right now on this planet. There is such food scarcity that people are either starving to death or they're breaking in to find food. They are also going to represent the largest migration in world history. Environmental victims, they will be finding places in their own country or in other countries that they can at least have a chance to survive. We have not given this any time or attention in the mainstream media. We feel that 2100 is the year. He is saying it's now. And he said it's now in 2010. It was a prescient moment because in the last 8 years, everything that you're going to hear him talk about has come true. And it's only getting worse. Mind you, we've never had James Hansen, Guy McPherson, any of the other dozens of environmentalists that we've spoken with, not one has been an insider to the degree this person is, and he's telling us about what we're not looking at. What happens when people can't eat? They're going to rebel. The government wants to know the likely outcome, where that's going to be, when it's going to happen, and what the feedback loops can be. He is also going to present to you a very clear look at the truth of why global warming will not be reversed. In fact, when he was talking about 394 parts per million, it's now over 420. So we've exceeded the threshold he said we shouldn't exceed. And we are closing in on 2 degrees Celsius increase in many parts of the world. So listen carefully. This was a 2010, 8-year-old lecture, but it was one of the most unique and rare and honest expressions of a person speaking before a group. I don't know the group. It didn't show me the group, but you have a full hour listening to this person give you an idea. Now, he later on, at the very end, he talks about one of the solutions that he and others are looking at, which is geoengineering. Now, that was in 2010. Now, we've seen the consequences of what they've done with geoengineering, and it is impractical, and it is also dangerous. I simply want to posit that before we hear what he has to say on it. But nonetheless, the vast majority of the material he is sharing I would agree with, except I wouldn't agree on the solutions he's suggesting. Now let's go to Dr. Gwen Dyer.
I'm going to talk tonight about, you might say, the intersection between climate change and politics. Not domestic politics, but international politics. Because it seems to me that that's probably the piece of the largest piece of the equation that simply isn't on the table. And I first became aware of it about 3 years ago now. I was in Washington. I often go there because you got to go there to figure out what they're up to, you know. And when I go, I usually stay with an old friend who has spent his career. Well, he actually did his PhD in British policy on the Northwest frontier, you know, up by Afghanistan. So shortly after that, he got hired by the intelligence services, and he's done a whole career, right, in the intelligence services. And we were sitting around his flat one evening. And he dropped into the conversation the fact that the Pentagon, Joint Chiefs of Staff, to be precise, was getting interested in climate change. So I said, why? And he said, well, I don't know. But he gave me a couple of names, and they were actually people who worked for, I think it's called J5. Anyway, it's the cell within the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is, if you'll pardon the hyperbole, the brains of the Army. These are sort of the long-range scenario mongers, the planning stuff. And they were working on this. And they were working on this under the administration of Mr. Bush. It was a career killer to be known to be interested in this in public. So they were doing it very quietly in the back room, but they were doing it. That's interesting. So I went back to London and I began asking around in London circles, the military circles, defense, ministry defense circles I know, about the Brits, and by God, they're doing it too. In fact, that's where I first heard the phrase, lifeboat Britain. And I'll skip ahead a long way and explain that phrase because I think it's what hooked me. What's being discussed quietly in Whitehall, in the British military, is this. If, and I would say when, the warming proceeds to the point where there are very serious global food shortages, and where the refugees are flowing north out of Africa, and they're beginning to flow north out of the Mediterranean as well, because the temperatures are intolerable and there are food shortages there, which are probably too great for the northern members of the European Union to cover, we don't want to be swamped. Because the British Isles probably flat out farming every single piece of land that isn't actually vertical and eating not much meat could just about feed themselves if they don't let a lot of people in. Lifeboats get swamped if they let too many people aboard. And this phrase was the shorthand for a whole line of thinking that is beginning to occur within the British government, within the Ministry of Defense. You're dealing here with a government that thinks long term, right? We're not talking about Ottawa. And And I can't detect any discussion of this matter in Ottawa at all. But yeah, so that phrase, I think more than anything else, got me going. Oh, there's something up here. And it's sort of up my alley now. So I began interviewing people, military people, particularly recently retired senior military people, because they're so grateful if somebody remembers they're still there. I mean, you know, you've had a driver for 20 years, and then suddenly not only are you taking your own car for a spin, but nobody phones and asks your opinion. So they're grateful if you do. And they will talk. But also talking to the scientists, I visited the Hadley Center, which is the big British climate research center, and the Boulder, Colorado, the National Center for Atmospheric Research in the States, and the Potsdam Institute, and I must have talked to a couple of dozen scientists whose names you might recognize. As I traveled around the world, because I, you know, sort of have a little 18-month round where you have to get to all of the major capitals, at least, I put some people on the list to interview, generals and policymakers and scientists. And basically what I'm going to do this evening is tell you what I learned, what I know now that I didn't know at the start. And it will come in four packages. The first conclusion is that this is moving much faster than the public debate acknowledges. The public numbers, which we are all still using, are the numbers that were generated by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, in 2007. Every 4 or 5 years, they get a couple of thousand scientists together. It's a UN-affiliated, sub-organization. And these scientists go review all the scientific peer-reviewed research that's been published since the last time they all met. It's a year-long process. All the committees meet for a long time. And then they publish a report which is written for governments. People don't understand. These are not freelancers. This is paid for by governments run by the UN. Governments which actually don't want to hear very bad news. So there's this arm wrestle at the end between what the scientists want to say and what the governments are willing to let into the executive summary of the report, which is, of course, all the journalists ever read. So these are the numbers that we're working on. These numbers, which were, for example, the numbers used at the Copenhagen summit, that train wreck we had last December, are universally regarded by the scientists themselves as low. They are numbers that say that we're likely to see between 1.8 and 5.8 degrees Celsius higher average global temperature by the end of this century. Well, hell, you know, it might only be 2 degrees, and we got 90 years to play with. I don't have to rush. Those are the public numbers. I don't think a single scientist I talk to believe those numbers. Partly because they know what the process was of basically haggling down the forecasts by government. And also the fact that all these committees work by consensus, the IPCC committees, so therefore, basically the lowest common denominator is what gets into the report. But also because, really, the data in the IPCC report are very old. Published in 2007, the committees met through 2006. None of the data, none of this peer-reviewed scientific reports is more recent than the end of 2005. That's when they imposed a cutoff date. They didn't want more stuff falling on the table every day as they worked through the process. So none of the data is newer than the end of 2005. But actually, if you think about it, we're talking published scientific research, right? So first of all, it had to go through a peer review process, which those of you who do this sort of thing for a living will be aware is not exactly rapid. followed unless you've got dynamite news by a year's queue or more to get into the damn journal that you're publishing it in. So now we're back to 2003, and the question you now have to ask is, how old is the data? Because when they wrote the research up, they've already finished gathering their data set. So the data we're working with are 8, 9, 10 years old. The latest data in that published report, which is the basis of our public conversation. You look at what's been happening in the real world since 2006, for example, to Arctic ice cover, which crashed in 2006 to almost half of its previous minimum. And you come to different conclusions. And the real forecasts that people are working with, the ones that they draw up the scenarios for, are much more serious than this. The one that I found both most credible and most frightening was one that was produced by the Hadley Center just before that conference in December of last year. Hadley Center, it's in southwest England. It was opened, by the way, by Margaret Thatcher. It is only in North America that people who take climate change seriously are on the left and people who doubt it are on the right. In the rest of the world, it's not a left-right issue any more than gravity is. Margaret Thatcher was to the right of Attila the Hun, but she was a scientist. So the Hadley Center, just before December, the big Copenhagen, we're going to fix everything summit, published a forecast of where they thought climate change warming would be in 2060. That is to say, 50 years down the road, not 90, 50. And they said, higher average global temperature rise, 4 degrees Celsius average. Think about that for a minute. Where are we by the end of the century? Almost certainly way past the 6 degrees, which was the IPCC's end of century estimate. And then they published, together with that, a map of the world in which they showed what 4 degrees average global temperature means in terms of local temperature. Because, of course, 2/3 of the planet is covered with ocean. And the oceans are much cooler than the land surfaces of the planet. So that average isn't about what it feels like in Canada, particularly in central Canada. The map showed Britain getting off rather easily, actually. 4 degrees higher average global temperature. It's only 3 degrees higher in England because it's surrounded by ocean and it's rather a long way from the equator. And the closer you are to the equator, the more serious the impacts, though not necessarily. Well, that's too complicated to get into. Central Canada, Quebec, Ontario, the prairies, 7 degrees Celsius in 2060. On the coast here, 5, 5.5. Are we still growing grain? I don't know. You're pushing it. The Russians had 35 degrees all this summer and they lost almost half their grain crop. So, much deeper water and flowing quite fast than we are discussing in public. Why would the number be so much higher? Because the Hadley Center, in drawing up these numbers, did not just deal with the assumption that they all make, which is that we will continue to reduce our emissions at a rate that is inadequate to the problem. We will reduce our emissions. There will be electric cars or some kind of cars that don't run on petroleum fuel within 20 years in, you know, large numbers. Sure there will, and that's a bit late, guys. And likewise, you know, they aren't building any. Not one new coal-fired power station has been built in the United States in the last 2 years. Congratulations, Sierra Club. But there's hundreds of the things, and they'll be running for 30 years or so because that's their lifespan. Nobody's going to tear them down and replace them. So, yes, we'll cut our emissions, but we won't do it in time to prevent huge harm being done. So the assumption is that we will pass through the point of no return. The point of no return is 2 degrees Celsius higher. 450 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, to put it in a more scientific phrasing. Everybody in the business reckons we're going to 500 or 550, if we're lucky, before we stop the rise. We're at 390 now. We were at about 280 at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So, you know, it's kind of hard to stop this. It's a juggernaut. So there's that assumption. We're going past 250. When I say 450, 2 degrees, when I say that it's the point of no return, it's the point of no return in this specific sense that we lose control around 2 degrees hotter. Until then, it's our emissions that are causing the warming, so we can turn them off, at least in theory, if we choose, and thereby stop the warming. There is about a 20-year lag before turning them off stops the warming, but you can do it until you reach around 2 degrees. All of these numbers are fairly fuzzy, but what happens around 2 degrees is that the consequences of the warming trigger natural processes that contribute further to the warming, positive feedbacks, as they are called, in which the permafrost melts and releases huge amounts of carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere, in which the surface waters of the oceans become so warm they can no longer contain all of the carbon dioxide they absorbed earlier. High school physics, right? Warmer water can contain less dissolved gas. Buy yourself a beer and you'll see what I mean. If you don't drink it, it goes flat as it warms up. So all of those feedbacks kick in around 2 degrees, and then you've lost control to the point where you may not be able to stop the warming process even if you stop all of your own emissions. So you're trapped on this escalator that's taking you up through 3, 4, 5, 6 degrees. 6 degrees is mass death, higher average global temperature. Because, of course, it translates into a great deal more than that on the surface of the on the land surface of the planet. Mass death mainly from starvation, not from heat stroke, but mass death is mass death. So when the Hadley Center put these numbers out, they were incorporating, which the IPCC does not, the early impacts of positive feedbacks, as well as just how much carbon dioxide will we put into the air by 2060. First time that had been done, but it gives you a really frightening number. And then they did the map, which is, again, something that's not normally done. And the consequence is we don't have a lot of time. We're in deep trouble. And the military know this. The military know this everywhere. It's except here. The people whose names you would recognize if you've been reading the literature, people like Jim Lovelock and Jim Hansen, the very serious scientist, John Schellnhuber in Germany, people like that, they are flown in to the Pentagon to talk to people all the time. John Holdren, who's now Obama's science advisor. They talk to the Pentagon all the time. The Pentagon takes this very seriously. So we have a problem, Houston. And the reason the military become involved is because of the geopolitics of it. The damage does not occur equally across the planet. Countries closer to the equator are much harder hit than countries further away from the equator, because The major impact is on the food supply, and it is in the tropics and the subtropics that we lose a lot of food production. I had no idea how much until I started looking into it, but it's really, I mean, the rule of thumb is that you lose 10% of global food production for every 1 degree Celsius higher average global temperature. The relationship may break down in the higher orders, but at 1, 2, 3, 4, that's what happens. That's a bit of a problem when you are pretty well stretched on feeding the existing almost 7 billion people, and you got another 1.5 billion or so coming before the population of the planet plateaus, and consumption's going up faster than population. As people get money in their genes, they're eating more meat. Even in India, they're eating more meat. And watch what happens to the prices of grain this fall as a result of half of the Russian grain crop being lost to heat and peat fires and so on. Well, I think 30%, but the number 50% is being bandied about. I mean, we had this 3 years ago, and we're likely to have it again. Grain prices may double. Right around the... And, of course, that means the poor starve, right? Rich never starve in food shortages. We ration by price. So food supply gets hit. If you want a thumbnail explanation of why it is in the tropics and the subtropics that the food supply gets hit, it's this. In the tropics, most of the major food crops, like rice, are not native to the tropics. They were domesticated in more temperate areas and then introduced into the tropics. They are very near the top of their temperature tolerance range in the tropics now, in normal times. Rice, corn, things like that. So give it just a couple of degrees warmer, which isn't asking a lot. You know you're going to get there. And frankly, you lose huge amounts of the crop in the tropics. The tropics actually, you know, aren't going to see the kind of huge numbers in warming that are going to happen further away from the equator. But the only 2 degrees up, rice, for example, will not germinate. Standard paddy lowland rice will not germinate if the temperature is above 35 degrees Celsius for even 24 hours during the key three-week period when the grains of rice are fertilized, you know, the little flowers are fertilized and form the grains of rice. Well, you know, we're talking, look at Burma or Indonesia or something like that, it's 32, 33 all the time. So that's what happens in the tropics. In the subtropics, it's more a question of rainfall. The subtropics are a very rainfall short area anyway. You can usually get enough rain for one harvest a year, but nobody in the subtropics gets two or three harvests a year. And in the subtropics, the rain fails. By 50% it falls, or 75%. We're talking about the Mediterranean, both sides of it here. We're talking about Central America, Mexico, and the southern United States. We're talking, the southern United States is the subtropics. Florida is the subtropics. South Texas is the subtropics. And, of course, almost all of Australia, all of southern Africa, significant part of South America, all closer to the equator. And so you're going to face major local food shortages and a global food shortage as a consequence of that. If you knock half the major rice exporters out of the equation, which this will do, then you have global food shortages as well. Lots of countries in the further north and further south parts of the planet can still feed themselves, but they are not exporting wheat anymore. Take, for example, Australia, which has just stopped. Second largest wheat exporter on the planet 10 years ago, but it is the canary in the coal mine. It's the driest continent. It's almost all in the subtropics, except the southern fringe. And they've just gone through what they thought was a drought. It's not a drought, it's climate change. It ain't ever going back. This is the new normal, guys. And as a result, Australia has exported almost no wheat for the last 2 or 3 years. They can still feed themselves. There's only 20 million of the buggers, but they aren't exporting wheat for that can be used to fill in the gaps elsewhere. And this will happen in a lot of places. So food becomes the critical issue, and the countries most impacted are tropical and subtropical. And this is where the geopolitics comes from, you see. So now we're getting into the second conclusion. The problems, the geopolitical problems that attract the attention of the military are refugees, failed states, and wars. All driven by food shortages. We haven't lived in a food scarcity world for 200 years. We have no idea what it's like. There's an anthropologist friend of mine, a guy called Steve LeBlanc, he runs the Peabody Museum in Harvard, who wrote a book once called Constant Battles about pre-civilized human beings and how they actually lived. Not the fantasy version where they lived in, you know, the Garden of Eden and wore flowers in their hair. But the real ancient world where food shortages, including ones that you could die from, were a regular occasion. And his rule of thumb is people always raid before they starve. Raid the neighbors. Now, doesn't automatically, inevitably follow that large civilized society will do the same as small hunter-gatherer bands, but it's the same people, you know. So the military think that there's going to be a lot of work for them. I mean, I can't discern, and I don't see how you would separate their motives into the good ones, they just want to be ready to deal with trouble, and the bad ones, they're looking for a justification for their existing budget, and the present justifications are getting a bit thread-worn, so we need some new ones. I can be quite cynical about this on occasion, but I have taken my pills today. But they're right that, I mean, you talk to the U.S. military, for example, their, I'd say, obsession in the planning, I mean, not your average grunt or his, you know, platoon officer, but in the thinking parts of the military, the obsession is Mexico. Because there's a 3,000 kilometer border between Mexico and the United States. There are 100 million people in Mexico and another 50 million south of them in Central America. The farms there are going to dry up and blow away. There's already a well-established pattern when you're in deep trouble and you can't feed your family, head north. There is an existing arrangement on the U.S. border which might be described as catch some and let some go. I mean, it's not really fortified. It looks pretty impressive in the cities where people can see it, but if you drive 10, 15 kilometers out of town, east or west along the border, you're down to three strands of barbed wire at a dirt patrol track with a vehicle down it every 4 hours. It is actually meant to allow lots of people to get through, because cheap illegal labor is what keeps American agribusiness profitable. And the reason that it's cheap is because the workers are illegal and they can't bargain. So there is a reason for all this, though not one we can speak of in front of the children. This provides a safety valve for the Mexican state. It provides cheap labor for American farmers. And, you know, the flow is maybe 500,000 a year, 1 million a year, and half of them go home again after the harvest. We can deal with that. There's 300 million people in the United States, drop in the bucket. But try 5 million a year, because the things have fallen apart and there's no food in Mexico. What do you do at 5 million a year? Well, the U.S. Army is convinced that the Congress will tell them to close that border. Really close it. And they can do that. It's absolute nonsense, so you'll hear it often enough in the States to go, ooh, I don't know, 2,000 miles of border, we could never shut that. Bullshit. Iron Curtain, do you remember the Iron Curtain? But the dirty secret is that you can only shut a border if you're willing to kill people. An exemplary few hundred will generally do, but you actually have to be willing to kill people. And, you know, I reckon the U.S. Army is probably willing to do that because, you know, they don't have an ingrained philosophical objection, certainly, to killing people. But they do understand that actions have consequences. I mean, these are serious people. And they do understand, as several of them said to me, that if we are killing people on the border, killing Mexicans, killing Central Americans on the border who are trying to get through, that will get, you know, everybody's got cameras now, including video cameras, even if it's just the phone one. And so this is going to be up on the web and maybe up on the evening news, and 20% of the resident U.S. population, most of them perfectly legal citizens, will be of recently arrived Mexican or Central American descent when this happens. And how are they going to feel about us shooting their distant relatives at the border? One officer said to me, I reckon this could cause the gravest social divisions in the United States since the American Civil War. So it does get complicated. That's what they're thinking. Refugees is the major issue that obsesses the Americans. It obsesses the Europeans, and I sort of trailed that a little bit with the Lifeboat Britain idea. The European Union, it's quite interesting. You go to Brussels, the capital of the European Union, such as it is, and there's one particular kind of conversation which can only occur when the Spanish and the Italians and the Greeks and Portuguese aren't present. So it takes place in the corridors or in the pubs. And it is this rather desultory conversation at this point in the proceedings, but people kicking ideas around about what do we do when these are all not just food deficit areas, but areas that we can't even supply with enough food to keep them going. You're talking about a lot of people here. Right? 100 million plus? I mean, everybody knows this is coming. I was in the Netherlands recently, and they're planning to raise the level of that sort of inland sea they've got, the Zuiderzee, by a meter and a half. And there's various reasons, hydrological reasons for doing that, but they figured out what to do with the extra water. They're going to sell it to Spain. Serious. This is part of the Dutch Delta Commission's planning. So everybody knows bad things are going to happen in Southern Europe, and the problem is that at the moment there's freedom of movement within the European Union. You're Italian, you want to move to Sweden and open up a plant or a shop or whatever, you can do it. Nobody can tell you not to. A few forms to fill out, but no permissions required. You want to just travel there, nobody even looks at a passport. There aren't any passports on most of the passport checks, any checkpoints at all on most internal European borders anymore. So at the moment, all those people could move north. But, you know, while Northern Europeans quite like Italians, and it's nice to have a million or a half a million around, who wants 5 million or 10? And the answer is nobody. I mean, you know, if the shoe were on the other foot, the Italians wouldn't want them either. In fact, the Italians don't want the Africans that are coming in at the bottom end. So that means that at some point down the road, and this is the conversation you can't have when the subjects are present, we're going to have to stop free movement in Europe. We're going to have to stop the freedom of Southern Europeans to move to Northern Europe. Does this mean we have to divide into sort of what used to be the European Union north of the Alps and something else below it? Don't know. But that's the kind of conversation that's going on. Yes, the Australians have just doubled the size of the navy they deploy off their north coast because they anticipate refugee flows south out of Indochina, Indonesia, the Philippines. I keep talking to the South Africans about this, but they've got so much on their minds. But the same issue, the only industrialized country and the only country with some temperate zone in all of Africa has open borders at the moment. And 5 million foreigners living in a country of 45 million people. That could go to 45 million if things get really rough further north. So that's the sort of thing that's going through people's minds. Refugees is a first, and refugees who may have to be stopped by force. So there's that. Then what happens to the governments of the places they're trying to get away from? No government that cannot feed its population survives, not for long. So we're talking failed states. We're talking a proliferation of failed states, particularly across Africa and large parts of the Middle East, which is where it will be worst. Africa gets absolutely hammered by this because almost all of Africa, except the Western Cape, actually, is either in the tropics or the subtropics. There is no other apart from the Western Cape, there's no temperate zone. Well, very high bits of Kenya and so on. There's no temperate zone. So, you can expect failed states as well as the refugee flows. And then, jackpot, on river systems shared by numbers of countries, war is virtually inevitable at some point. Because the upriver states will keep more than their agreed share, or will demand a larger share if that's not what they already have. When there's not enough water to go around, if you have a way of diverting it into your irrigation system, you do it. It's starting up on the Nile now. The old agreements on the Nile have been repudiated by the upstream states. And they're setting up a sort of alternative Nile Valley organization that excludes Egypt and Sudan, the major downstream beneficiaries now. I think Turkey and Iraq would be at war today if Iraq wasn't flat on its back and incapable of fighting anybody, because the Turks have built 12 huge dams in eastern Turkey, and they are using those dams to irrigate eastern Turkey. The rivers in question are the Tigris and the Euphrates, the two rivers that define Mesopotamia. There's virtually no water in the Euphrates. It's not reaching the point where the rivers used to join, just north of Basra. Hasn't done all of this summer. So agriculture is basically shut down in western Iraq this summer. Now, at the moment there's still an international grain market, and the Iraq's got a lot of money because it's got oil. But in a time when the Iraqi state was not flat on its back, I think there'd be a war over this. There will, at some point, almost certainly, be a war between India and Pakistan over it. Works like this. Pakistan is Egypt at three times the scale. It depends almost entirely on the waters of the Indus. It's the largest irrigated area in the world. 85% of Pakistan's food comes from the Indus River and the land irrigated from the Indus River, which of course doesn't reach the sea anymore. They take all water out of it. But five of the six tributaries of the Indus River flow through India or Indian-controlled Kashmir before they reach Pakistan. Now, there is a treaty, it's 50 years old this year, on the division of the waters between the two countries. The Pakistanis always figure they got gored by it, but at the moment they actually do get about 70% of the total flow. India only gets 30%. It gets all of the flow in the three eastern tributaries, which are much smaller. And it gets an allotted share of the flow, which it can take out upstream itself, of the flow in two of the three tributaries that Pakistan owns. But that share is defined not as a share, a proportion of what's there, but as a fixed volume of water. Now, it turns out to be about 30% of current flow. But those rivers, and certainly the Pakistani ones, are glacier-fed. And the glaciers are melting. They're going, according to the Chinese Academy of Sciences, at 7% a year. So they'll all be gone in 20 years. And what you can look forward to is 20 years of flooding. You notice it has been flooding rather in Pakistan at the moment. That's largely to do with the monsoon, but it's also more flow than you wanted. So 20 years of flooding, and then after that, when the glaciers are all gone, the rivers are half empty in the summer, because that's what keeps them full in the summer. It doesn't rain in the summer up there, the headwaters. So, not enough water to go around, not enough water for anybody, but the problem is India is still entitled to take a fixed volume of water out of the rivers that belong to Pakistan. And do you think it's going to go, oh, shucks, this isn't fair. We should take less and only take, you know, the equivalent proportion to what we used to take when the river was full. So it was 30% then. We'll go down to 30% of what's left now. Sure, they will say that. India is a democracy, but that means it's answerable to the public. No Indian politician could say that and survive. I mean, India's got to have its own problems. I was in New Delhi not that long ago, and I was interviewing the head of a think tank there, who's run by a woman whose husband is the head of the Planning Commission, which is a super powerful body in New Delhi. They're kind of a tag team, they play very rough. But she dropped into the conversation almost by the way, that she just finished doing a contract for the World Bank, which had asked her to figure out how much agricultural production India lost at 2 degrees Celsius higher average global temperature. So you figure out average local, and then, you know, how much rainfall you got left, and come back and tell me how close you are to feeding yourself at 2 degrees higher average global temperature. So she put her people on it, they did all the due diligence, and they went back and reported that India lost 25%. Of its food production at 2 degrees higher. So is India going to be in the mood to cut a little slack to poor old Pakistan? Doubt it. Pakistanis are starting to starve. Both of these countries have nuclear weapons, and people always raid before they starve. That's the sort of thing that we're looking at here. The deeper into this process we go, the higher the likelihood that this sort of event will become commonplace. So it's not just a deadline you mustn't pass 450 parts per million. It's a deadline you mustn't get so deep into the process that countries are fighting each other or not talking to each other or falling into failed state status. Because after that, no deals are possible. You're not even talking to each other anymore. Conclusion 3, we're going to go through the point of no return and probably a good deal further in terms of the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Almost certain. We are at 395, actually, at the moment, parts per million. And before the current recession cut the growth rates a little bit, we were growing at 3 parts per million a year in our emissions, mainly now due to the rapidly industrializing countries of the third world who are having to increase their power generation capacity by 10-12% a year. We're not doing that here. We're replacing old generating capacity with new generating capacity on a 40-year turnover basis, but it's there that all the new stuff's going in. Don't blame them. We put our stuff in earlier. We did the same job. But now it's them. So do the math. We're at 395. Mustn't go past 450. 55 divided by 3 tells you when you've passed the point of no return. Not a happy thought, is it? And can you really believe that we're going to get the politics of this right enough to bring that down steeply in the next 20 years? Get ahead of the curve? I don't know anybody who believes it. Which is why there is this undercurrent of panic in a lot of the conversations, in fact, most of the conversations that you have with the scientists. They cannot see how we are going to avoid going past the point of no return, where we lose control, where the feedbacks kick in, which is what, of course, Hadley Center was talking about, or partly what it was talking about when it gave us that 4 degrees in 2060 forecast. I have children, I have grandchildren, I am not tremendously pleased by this news. And there is, maybe, a way to cheat. And that is geoengineering, which could get you lynched if you mentioned it in scientific circles 3 or 4 years ago. It was absolutely taboo to talk about geoengineering, direct interference in the climate system in order to hold temperature down and not go through that 2 degrees Celsius point of no return. It was regarded as absolutely grounds for expulsion from the community to talk about that in public before, in front of the children, us, the great unwashed, on the grounds that we were bound to get the raw end into the stick here and say, oh, so we don't have to cut our emissions, we can just hold the temperature down. Well, no, of course you can't do that. You've got to get your emissions down. The acidification of the oceans continues. All sorts of other nasty effects of large amounts of carbon dioxide and methane going into the atmosphere continue. And, of course, with every year that passes, the difference between whatever temperature you've engineered and the real temperature you will immediately inherit if you stop engineering gets bigger and bigger. So you have to cut your emissions. But you could win another 20 or 30 years to get your emissions down without paying the horrendous penalties you will pay by going through 2 degrees if you can geoengineer. And somewhere around 2 years ago, it began to turn in scientific circles, and people who previously would not talk in public about this stuff began to talk about it in public on the grounds that this is the only way we have any chance of getting through this without taking huge casualties. Nobody's talking about the human race disappearing. Nobody's talking about the death of life on Earth. We're talking about hitting a temperature that we haven't seen on this planet for 35 million years. But actually, 6 degrees hotter. We've been there before. The Earth's fine. The Earth system's fine. The only problems are that all the tropics and the subtropics and a good deal of the temperate zone is open desert, and the only really suitable zones for life are around the poles down below the Arctic Circle, but not that far south of the Arctic Circle, which is why if you go back to that period geologically and you do the digging, you find crocodiles living on Baffin Island. They're in the dark half a year, but that's where there's light living going on. So, and there'd be human beings left at 6 degrees warmer, but I really don't think there'd be too many. So if you don't want that, you'd better start thinking, and you don't believe that we can shut down the growth in emissions fast enough. If you can believe that, do it, but have a plan B, and plan B is geoengineering. The first man to go public with it was a fellow called Paul Crutzen, about 2.5-3 years ago now. Very serious dude. He got the Nobel Prize as an atmospheric chemist for his work on the ozone hole. So he knows about the upper atmosphere quite a lot, and it was he who said, look, we need a plan B here. And plan B is that we try to mimic what volcanoes do. When a big volcano explodes, it pushes very large amounts of gas and ash into the stratosphere. Small volcanoes just get into the lower atmosphere, the troposphere. But a big one will push a megaton of this stuff up into the stratosphere where it spreads around the planet, is fully distributed in a few weeks' time because of the upper altitude winds. And it stays in the stratosphere for a long time because there's no weather up there. You're above the weather. There's no rain. It doesn't wash out. On average, the stay time's about 2 years. And most of the gas is sulfur dioxide, and under, with sunlight hitting it in the upper atmosphere, The sulfur dioxide rapidly turns into tiny droplets of sulfuric acid, which reflect lots of incoming sunlight. And that sunlight doesn't reach the Earth's surface, and therefore you have a cooling effect at the surface. When Mount Pinatubo exploded in 1991, the big last big volcano in the Philippines, we had a 1.5 degree Celsius average global temperature lower for the following 2 years. Also gorgeous sunsets. So we could do that artificially. We could put enough sulfur dioxide up there to hold the temperature down by reflecting sunlight in the stratosphere. They've figured out how to do it. I mean, there's several proposals on the table for how to do it. But the one that sounds likeliest is that you simply use the same mid-air refueling aircraft that the Air Forces already own, and you fit them with tanks that can hold pressurized gas instead of aviation fuel, and you fly them up to the stratosphere, one enormous fart as you let all the sulfur dioxide out, and then you back down to the ground for another load. A dozen of those planes operating three sorties a day, and you've got enough up there to bring this temperature globally down by 1 degree Celsius in a year. Then you're going to have to replenish it from time to time, but not continuously. It stays up there for quite a while. So Crutzen put this proposal on the table. Well, he was ostracized. He took so much stick. I saw him recently, and he's okay. He's talking publicly again. For about 2 years, he just shut down. He wouldn't answer his phone. He was getting death threats. He was being disinvited from scientific conferences. I mean, he'd really overstepped the then bounds of the conversation. Where I saw him 5 months ago, however, was a conference in California of 200 scientists who are working very seriously on geoengineering, and they're all out of the closet. And this conference wasn't even about geoengineering techniques, it was about the governance of geoengineering research and deployment.
Well, there you have a unique insight. Could you imagine what the results of the American public demanding that we find alternatives for all plastic, demanding that we stop animal production, factory farming, demanding that we stop using chemicals that pollute our air, soil, and water, and food, demanding that we have a Marshall Plan, it would be a different outcome than what it's likely to be at this moment. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Have a good day.
Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't